Please silence all electronic devices.
That is an overwhelming number, and it's going to change elections in large and small ways. And they would do these, you know, little tricks on the other side that they would call rat effing.
Any further discussion or debate?
From the bunker of sweatshirts, this is the WUNC Politics Podcast. I'm Jeff Tabiri. Time again for another extended conversation, this time with an author and journalist. And for those of you who are truly North Carolina politicos, you've probably heard of David Daley's 2016 book, which is all about Red Map, a Republican plan to take back state houses and redraw political boundaries. In a bit, we'll talk about that book and its naughty title. First, our conversation pivots on the coronavirus and how the pandemic has him concerned about impacts on the election come November. We spoke over the phone last week, and I began by asking him to describe his recent existence during the pandemic.
I'm in Western Massachusetts. We have a 7-year-old, so, you know, the end of first grade has been wiped out, so we're trying to, you know, work and homeschool and just kind of keep ourselves together, you know. I think we cook more than we ever have before. Our son is a little too well caught up on Ninjago, but we're doing the best we can, as I hope everyone is down there.
It's obviously been very fluid for 2 months now. The health effects and impacts, have at times felt like a moving goalpost. There's the economic impacts, which feel still to some extent largely unknown and not totally understood. And then there are the electoral impacts of this pandemic. You have been outspoken in your concerns about how the pandemic may affect elections come this fall. So big picture to get us started, what are you most worried about?
We all saw the horrifying images from Wisconsin back in April when, in the middle of a pandemic, voters were essentially forced to make a choice between their health and their civic voice, and they had to go out to the polls in the middle of a stay-at-home order. And what I worry about is that come November, we could have 20 different examples of Wisconsin around the country, that this could play out on a much bigger scale, and that it complicates our ability to actually hold a free and fair election. And it keeps people from turning out at the polls. And none of this is necessary. We still have 170 odd days left before election day. There are things that we can do. There are preparations that we can make. We know what it is that we have to do. We have to expand vote by mail. We have to expand other options, and make sure that every voter has a variety of opportunities in front of them to cast their ballot.
There are several states that vote entirely by mail: Colorado, Hawaii, Oregon, Washington, Utah. Do you have any sort of estimate, or have you looked at this to try to get a sense of how many people we might be talking about across the country? And I've seen several billions of dollars thrown about as the figure, but how much money are we talking and how many people potentially are we talking about?
We don't have a whole lot of evidence on this. What we know is in Wisconsin, ordinarily, it's less than 10% of folks vote via absentee ballot. And in the April primary, it soared to about 80% of all votes or tests via absentee. In states like Pennsylvania, they are preparing as if they're going to have 75 or 80% of all votes cast through the mail. That is an overwhelming number, and it's going to change elections in large and small ways. In Pennsylvania, for example, there is a state statute that says you cannot begin counting ballots until election day. Well, if you've got, you know, millions of ballots being cast by mail and you can't start opening them on election day, it's going to take you much longer to actually get a count than it would otherwise.
Come November, we will have collectively been living through this pandemic for going on 8 months. And I'm wondering, from your perspective, why socially distanced voting can't happen. If we think about, and I'm just throwing a couple of items out here, separating everybody by at least 6 feet in line, having people provide or bring their own writing utensil, or providing a different writing utensil for everybody. Why can't socially distance voting take place, or can it?
I think Wisconsin, again, is a really vivid example of what has to happen if you're going to do in-person voting. And what you saw there was that in the city of Milwaukee, the election board was only able to open 5 of the 180 polling precincts that they usually have, in part because they could not get the number of staffers that they needed, volunteers to work the polls on election day. The kinds of folks who work at the polls are often senior citizens who are the most vulnerable. You could attempt to have everybody use a different pen. That would require hundreds of thousands of pens. That's something that they were trying to work on in Wisconsin. In the days ahead of that election, the state election officials were trying to buy hundreds of thousands of pens, hundreds of thousands of hand wipes, and they actually couldn't even procure what they needed at that level. That was earlier on in the pandemic. Maybe by November, states would be able to do that. Imagine what happens to these lines if you're only able to open 3% of your polling places, if everybody has to stand 6 feet apart, and then every single time someone goes into a machine, that machine has to be wiped down by somebody. That's an awful lot of effort. And we can find a really easy way around that. I'm not sure what we gain by forcing people to vote in that way. It seems to me that that is much more inefficient than simply saying, this year, we have to try to do this another way.
I wonder to what extent you think this conversation about moving to a greater vote-by-mail effort, some of the access questions and issues that you've raised here, how it plays in North Carolina, where there was, of course, a scandal 2 years ago. There was this election fraud, the ballot harvesting scheme in North Carolina's 9th congressional district that led to a special election last year. Now, we know that fraud is rare, but there is this recent example of it here, and I think it's only natural to acknowledge, if not accept, that that's going to be part of the conversation here in North Carolina. And I'm wondering if you think that with that in the not-too-distant rearview mirror would make North Carolina one of the heaviest lifts, so to speak, in terms of moving to widespread vote-by-mail?
It's a great question, and what happened in North Carolina was truly pretty shocking. But it was also uncovered, and it was uncovered because it was kind of obvious in many ways, right? There were folks who were going door to door trying to talk people out of their ballots, and they started talking, and a journalist picked up on it, and it became a news story. It's really hard to hide absentee ballot fraud at that level, as you all learned in November of 2018. It is a really inefficient way to steal an election. I think we should remember that when we talk about vote by mail. The actual academic studies on this, if you take a state like Oregon, which has been doing vote by mail now for, the better part of 2 decades, they have done, researchers have done complete studies of the hundreds of millions of votes that have been cast there. And you are looking at a low two-digit number. You know, it's in the teens, I believe, of actual, you know, proven cases of absentee ballot fraud. So, you know, certainly it's possible. It's also exceptionally rare.
You can follow David Daley on Twitter at Dave Daley, D-A-L-E-Y, 3. We're chatting about the pandemic. It's some of its potential implications come November on the election. We're also going to chat about some of what comes after the election, which in just a matter of months, a year's time, less than a year in some states, we'll see the next round of redistricting. Your first book, what's the title of your first book?
Am I able to swear on your WUNC podcast?
You know, you go ahead and we'll figure it out on the back end.
There we go. The name of my first book is Rat Fucked, Why Your Vote Doesn't Count.
And how does it read to the eye if I'm looking at it? Some of the letters are missing, right?
It reads Rat F'd, but, you know, I think the good people of North Carolina are able to fill in those asterisks.
Your first book was published in 2016, so you might have decided upon that title five, six, many years ago, but how come?
When you are writing a book about partisan gerrymandering, the most boring and wonky topic in the world, your publisher makes you come up with a title that is not boring and wonky. So that was what we landed on. I mean, it's actually a term that's got, you know, deep political history. It's really a political slang for, you know, a dirty deed done dirt cheap. And here is where I could break into an AC/DC song if you would like. And it comes into the political lexicon in the Nixon era. A lot of the folks around Nixon had come up in campus politics in USC, and they became involved in, you know, through H.R. Haldeman and others in Nixon's 68 and 72 campaigns. And they would do these, you know, little tricks on the other side that they would call rat effing.
So rat effed is about the Republican effort to win seats across the country in 2010 and then really take over the redistricting process, the redistricting round of 2011. This effort was called Red Map, and if memory serves, the GOP picked up more than 700 seats in state legislatures aggregate across the country. And one of the central figures in this undertaking is this man named Tom Hoffler. He has since passed away. He's a GOP operative. I think many listeners of the podcast will know that name, Tom Hoffler. He died a couple of years ago, and just troves and troves of data, some of what you've alluded to in our interview here, became public ultimately because his daughter, a daughter who had been estranged from him, turned them over to Common Cause. And that's just a little bit of context, but I'm wondering, in your process of writing the book, did you ever meet Tom Hoffler? Did you ever interview Tom Hoffler? I read the book, admittedly, years ago. I don't remember you having quoted Tom Hoffler. I don't think you quoted him in the book, but I'm wondering if you ever met him or interviewed him for the book. And if not, did you ever get a sense of what he thought of the book?
No one's ever asked me that. So I can tell you a story that I've never told anybody. I did attempt to interview Tom Hoffler for the book, and he turned me down. I was able to quote from his speeches and from his PowerPoints, and I wrote about him a lot in the book, but I didn't talk to him. We did trade emails later on over the years for other stories that I had written, and he never let on what he thought about the book one way or another. But I did receive access to all of his redistricting files. So, you know, last summer, they were leaked to me, and I was able to begin the process of going through, you know, tens of thousands of his files and his memos and his emails. And as I was going through those emails, I did find several in which he and other Republican operatives who were involved in Red Map talked about the book. There was an excerpt in New York Magazine about a month before it came out, and they were like, uh-oh, it looks like someone has kind of figured this out. I hope he spells all of our names right. They said, I think a couple of these guys might have had loose lips and talked a little bit too much. And they were certainly, you know, trading emails about it in the days before it came out.
It strikes me as having a little bit of the, we got caught in the cookie jar kind of thing. Is that a fair euphemism there?
I think that's right. You know, I mean, Hoffler, what's so ironic about Hoffler's files coming public is he was so scrupulous over the years about being super quiet. He was not the kind of guy who was giving interviews. He was happy being in the shadows. He wasn't looking to take credit for what he had done. He was, you know, a real operative. He wasn't, you know, lining up to become a pundit, you know, on CNN or to be quoted in news stories or anything. He was happiest with his computer and his data sets, working on maps. This is what Hoffler wanted to do. And he would go around the country giving lawmakers, you know, lessons on how to do this legally and quietly, and how to stay out of the newspapers. He would tell them, to, you know, take the masthead of their local paper and to tape it up above their computer and be like, you know, imagine any email you send winding up in the newspaper. Imagine everything you do becoming part of a court record. He was perhaps the Republican strategist who tried the hardest to tell people to do this quietly and outside of the prying eyes of the press. And as he lay dying, he left a trove of documents there. I'll never understand why. Did he want them to come out? He knew he was dying. He knew that the hard drives were in his bedroom. Why he didn't get rid of them, why he left them there to be found, is a fascinating question that I don't know the answer to.
Again, I full disclosure, I read your book. I think it was probably in 2017. I don't know. Everything's a blur. I have a 2-year-old, and time is it's all relative. But the anecdote I want to share with you and get your impression or reaction to is, I think it was last year. I think it was last spring. I was in the office of a prominent North Carolina lawmaker. And excuse me, I was in the office of the chief of staff of a prominent North Carolina lawmaker, and I saw the book on the shelf. And I thought, no way, that book is in the office of the chief of for the chief of staff to David Lewis. And I'm wondering if you knew that. I know you've met David Lewis a couple of times. I'm wondering what, because David Lewis is a central figure in the North Carolina redistricting story of 2011, right? I mean, he was the chair of the redistricting committee on the House side. He's the longtime rules chair of the House. He has had some well-known quotes that have been used time and time again. He has seen some of the maps that his committees have approved, been struck down in the courts, local maps, state maps, federal maps. That's probably more context than we need. But did you know that David Lewis, or at least David Lewis's chief of staff, had your book?
I did not know that the book was in his office. That is really wild. I'm not surprised. I think he's, you know, very media savvy, and his name appears in the book several times. So I'd be happy to come down and sign it for him. I was supposed to meet him in North Carolina at an event in Chapel Hill and had been very much looking forward to it. And at the last minute, there was some votes that had to be held, and he wasn't able to make it over, so he ended up joining virtually. So it was not, you know, quite the, you know, meeting of good and evil that I imagined it would be. But we had a very civil and, I think, productive, you know, conversation. I think he is a savvy operative, and I think he's gotten very good at, you know, presenting a very partisan case in an effective manner. But, you know, time and again, the maps that they drew have been thrown out as unconstitutional partisan and racial gerrymanders. And time and again, I think a party that is confident that it can win a fair election doesn't have to resort to cooking the lines in their favor. And what Lewis and the North Carolina legislature have done over the course of this last decade is to, you know, drop a weight on the scales. And I know that for many Republicans in North Carolina, they say, well, Democrats gerrymandered the state for 100 years before this, so why are you so upset about what we did in 2010 and 2011? There's a, you know, a conversation to be had, but in the end, these lines shouldn't belong to either political party. These district lines are the building blocks of our democracy, and when they get warped, and warped intentionally by lawmakers, it distorts everything about our elections and representation, and we have got to find a way to get this conversation away from what the Republicans did, away from what the Democrats did in, you know, in the 1990s, and back to how do we fix this?
I'm going to go rapid fire to get you out of here on. You are you're a graduate of Boston College. You're also a graduate of UNC Chapel Hill. You've got a master's in journalism at Carolina. When you return to Chapel Hill now, where's your first stop for dinner?
Lantern. I love Lantern.
435 U.S. House seats. How many will see truly competitive elections in November?
35.
What should that number be?
300.
A likelihood as a percentage, zero, never going to happen, 100%, it's a foregone conclusion, that someday you will run for elected office?
I've thought about it, but I think I am... Oh, boy. I have thought about it, but I think the likelihood is probably low. I think in the end, I'm just not that likable.
David Daly is the former editor-in-chief of Salon.com. David Daly, I enjoyed the conversation. Thanks for coming on the WNC Politics Podcast.
That was a lot of fun. Pleasure. Let's meet up in Atlanta.
David Daly is an author. His first book came out 4 years ago. It's called Rat Effed. Earlier this year, his latest book was released. It's titled Unrigged: How Americans Are Battling Back to Save Democracy. You can follow him on Twitter at DaveDaly3. I am appreciative of your ears finding this politics podcast each week, or however often you do listen, and my ears are open to you. What do you like or dislike about the program? Who do you want to hear from? Questions, comments, whatever, come find me. I'm on Twitter at J_Tibbs, email JTIBERII@WUNC.org. Thanks as always for listening. For David Daly, I'm Jeff Tiberi. We'll talk to you again soon.